His Glory, His Divine Story, every Thursday on Morning Glory. Catch the vibe with me, Karuna Munshi, on Radio Sai's Thursday Live on Asia Stream at 9:40 a.m.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Om Shri Sai Ram. Loving salutations at the lotus feet of Bhagwan Shri Satya Sai Baba, the love of our lives, the wind beneath our wings, the beat of our hearts, the one who is also the voice, the ears, the heart and soul of Radio Sai. Sai Ram and good morning dear listeners and welcome to Thursday Live. You're tuned to our Asia stream coming to you live from Prashanti Nilayam, India, the spiritual capital of the universe. My name is Karuna and I thank you for staying with us on this Thursday, June the 16th, 2016. You are tuned to this live broadcast from Prashanti Nilayam, the abode of Supreme Peace, where the time right now is 9:40 a.m. Indian Standard Time. Current weather conditions in Prashanti Nilayam: the sizzling summer is definitely over. This week, our daytime highs have not crossed 33 degrees Celsius or about 90 or 91 Fahrenheit, and our overnight lows have dipped to a comfortable 22 degrees Celsius or 72 Fahrenheit. Heavy to moderate monsoon showers are drenching us in short spells quite regularly these days. Mostly they come around in the evening time. And a few times we had overnight rains also. Naturally, there is a comfortable tinge of moisture in the air and the breeze is cool and relaxing and especially pleasant in the mornings and the evenings. Well, compared to the sweltering heat in rest of India, the weather in Prashanti Nilayam is relatively pleasant and quite welcoming. Dear sisters and brothers, this morning I am so thankful to Swami for finally making it happen. So what am I talking about? Well, the first episode of my special conversation with Professor G. Venkatraman is ready. And as I have been telling you in earlier episodes of Morning Glory, this is a three-part series. The first part is the essential primer. By that, I mean it is the much-needed foundation with some serious learning for all of us. The other two parts that will follow next Thursday and the one after that are much shorter and full of amazing insights, stories and experiences. But the second and third part make the most sense only after one understands the background that is laid in part one, which I shall air for you very shortly. So I guess it's time for me to reveal the topic for this special conversation. The splendor of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis, a musical tradition from Prashanti Nilayam that is quite young and associated with the Aradhana Mahotsavam. And I believe this conversation and this tradition especially, is bound to find its rightful place in history. And today with Swami's blessings, I'm confident enough to say that in about 50 or 100 or 150 years from now, posterity will fall back upon this conversation while attempting to understand the genesis and the history of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis. And who better than Professor G. Venkatraman to walk us through the background of using sound as a means for adoration of God. And why sound? And what is the science behind it? That is the physics as well as the metaphysics. I promise you this is going to be quite an eye-opener in more ways than one. And along the way, we will discover a few unknown and highly interesting facts about my expert guests in this series. That is Professor G. Venkatraman in part 1 and 2. And in part 3, it is Professor Venkatraman joined by my colleague, Mr. C.G. Sai Prakash. And dear listeners, I want you to know something. If you have any questions, comments, suggestions, feedbacks for my guests regarding this conversation, just feel free to email us immediately at listener@radiosai.org. And you're most welcome to CC me at karuna@radiosai.org. karuna@radiosai.org. I will gladly forward it to all my guests for further action and their responses. At Team Radio Sai, we love hearing from our listeners because for us, Swami listens through you, dear sisters and brothers. With that, let us get on with part one of this special conversation on the splendor of Sai Pancharatna Kritis. Take a listen, please. Sairam, dear listeners, the term Nada Brahma is one of the most exciting and expansive concepts in Indian philosophy. The simple meaning of the term Nada Brahma comes from two words. Nada, a Sanskrit word which means sound. Brahma, name of God as creator. Therefore, Nada Brahma means that sound is God. Let's further contemplate on the fact that scientific research today has come up with the recognition that all creation is energy in movement, a vibration, with each vibration having its own sound, color, visual pattern. Coming to the life of our beloved Bhagwan Sri Sathya Sai Baba, adoration of God through the medium of sound, be it Vedic or Buddhist chantings, bhajans, carols, classical music, both vocal and instrumental, Carnatic, Hindustani or Western. Sound has played a very significant role in feeling love for and closeness to God. In India, sages and saints through the centuries have promoted adoration of God through music. And one such example that has gained global momentum is the famed Tyagaraja festival. Closer to home, in the light of the Mahasamadhi of Bhagwan Baba, a movement is emerging right here in Prashanthi Nilayam, where classical musicians have offered a series of 5 songs known as the Sai Pancharatna Kritis in the Divine Presence during the recent Aradhana function. Today we hope to trace this journey by going back in time. We will look at the root of this tradition from various points of view, be it metaphysics, physics, Vedic principles or beyond. And through a 3-part discussion, we will explore the topic all the way to the story of the recent Sai Pancharatna Kritis. Walking us through this journey is Professor G. Venkatraman of Radio Sai. He will be our guide for the first 2 episodes. And in the final and 3rd episode, my colleague, Mr. C.G. Sai Prakash, will also join Professor Venkatraman in recording for posterity the birth and background history of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis. With that primer, I am very happy to welcome Professor G. Venkatraman to the show. Sai Ram, sir.
Sai Ram, and thank you for having me as your guest today.
I couldn't think of anybody else who could guide us or walk us through this. So, it's our pleasure, sir. Sir, our ability to greet each other with Sai Ram is a prime example of God's gift to us in the form of a tongue that facilitates this linguistic communication. Isn't this one of the reasons that makes us the crown of creation?
I would say the tongue is an organ that many animals have, including the snake, which has 2 tongues, I believe. The point is, the tongue in the human mouth appears to have extra flexibility. That is one thing. This other thing is that our throat muscles are enormously flexible and capable. It is this combination of 2 batsmen, shall I say, that allows us to produce sounds of various frequencies and various other attributes that sound has. I don't remember the technical words for it. And also, with the help of our throat muscles, we can modulate our voice.
Yes.
You know, you hold it at one note, but you can go above and below that note. And you see this in opera singers very often. And that is an enormous gift. God has given us a lot of other gifts which people don't pay attention to, like the enormous flexibility and plasticity of the body. No other creature on earth has that ability. God has given us 10 fingers with which we can do wonders. No other animal can do that. And God has given an enormously powerful brain which can think incredibly fast and do incredible things. And the power of the brain, as Krishna says, has come directly from Him.
Mm-hmm.
He says that in the Gita, in that 10th chapter, I believe. So, we are exceptional in many dimensions, and we are also exceptional in the fact that we don't realize it.
In our ignorance of our gift.
Self-imposed, I might add.
And now this gift of sound that we have, the ability to communicate through voice modulation, this is something that changes with time, isn't it? A child's voice is different, and then with age.
Obviously, for a number of reasons. First of all, when you grow, your size increases. I'm not saying this to say that people become fat. You grow from a small baby to an adult. An adult has a size, the baby has a size. So the size of the organs increases.
Yeah.
The volume of the throat box also increases.
Mm-hmm. It's the loudest in teenagers.
No, but that is not because their throat size is very big. It is tuned to high frequency.
Mm-hmm.
It is created in such a way that it can produce high frequencies. And also the muscles can move very fast. To produce a shrill note, your muscles have to move very fast, high frequency. Whereas, as you grow old, even the voice of ladies becomes bass.
Mm-hmm.
If you have heard the songs of M.S. Subbulakshmi over a period of time, her first recording was made when she was 13. I have heard that. And I've heard her in a later period, the voice became more and more bass. And there came a time when she came here when she said she could not sing.
Mm-hmm.
Swami said, "Why don't you sing?" She said, "Swami, I can no longer sing." You even come down to that stage.
My God. After such a fantastic career as a singer.
See, age does not respect any of those things. You may be anybody. Age is age. Body is body. And time will take its toll.
Mm-hmm. I think same with Lata Mangeshkar's voice too. The way she sang as a young girl, and
it happens to everybody.
Yeah.
It happens to everybody.
So the best of them.
Nobody can escape. In fact, you don't have to go that far. If you hear Swami's discourses of the 60s, it's very shrill.
Yes.
And then if you go down to the 2000s, it is deep, low frequency.
That is right. Divine discourses.
And there came a time when he found it difficult to speak.
Yes.
But there was another remarkable thing about Swami, which was very interesting. There were days when he could not speak. It was very difficult for him. But he would come, see the audience. From somewhere he will get the energy. He will give the discourse. Afterwards, he would find it very difficult to speak.
I see.
The very sight of the devotees puts in him
the energy.
Some extra energy. And then he comes out. But afterwards, I heard him say that. You know, when I see them, it is so nice. Spontaneously, I'm able to speak.
Mm. Wow. Now, when we speak of sound, in the Indian tradition, we clearly identify two sources of sound. As the Vedas say, sound from the mouth and sound from the nabi or the navel, the belly button. Could you guide us with that?
Sound is produced when air is expelled. Basically, it is squeezing out of sound. Now we have a stock of air here.
Yeah.
And if you expel that air, you get a quality of sound. You have sound in the lungs. Now to expel that, you have to sort of use your diaphragm. And the diaphragm begins somewhere near the belly. And when it moves up, then that sound will be expelled. Mm-hmm. Then you get a lot more sound. And you get a bigger resonating column, so to say.
I see.
So that adds richness to the sound, dignity to the sound, and depth of the sound. So to create that sound, you have to make an effort. And the belief is that it is only that sound that would be appealing to God. For the simple reason, Brahma the creator came from the navel of Lord Narayana or Mahavishnu, whichever you prefer. But there's a symbolic reference to that. And Tyagaraja says this in one of his songs, Navi Srikantarasana. From the sound must come from there. There is a tradition. Therefore, if you listen to the Vedic chants by a good Vedic scholar, they come for your our Dasara.
Yeah.
Some of them who are the old school tradition, it will be very. It will have what you call gambiram, grandeur, the richness.
Yeah.
And I heard
gravitas.
Gravitas. That's the right word.
Yeah.
And I heard Ms. Subbulakshmi tell two young girls. I went to a house of one professor here. He had invited her as a guest for lunch. I was also fortunate to be invited. She asked the girls to sing, his daughters, professor's daughters, in our staff quarters. And they sang, she said, song must come from the Navi, man, it should not come from the throat.
I
heard her say that personally. Yes. And then I realized that all the musicians, they also do it. And they do it because of the training exercises they were put through in the old days. You have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and then do Akara Sadagam. Akara is a tremendous practice. So, and they will be forced to do that. In fact, many of their musicians are given breathing exercise.
Yes, that is right. Lot of pranayam, lot of omkar chanting.
Yeah. So the quality of sound is enriched, and the gravitas of sound is enriched, and the sanctity is also enriched. There is a certain magnetic quality about Veda chanting done in a very nice way. Even if you don't understand what it is, there's something spellbinding about it.
Very rightly said. Just that vibration creates such a mood of stillness.
It does.
Yeah, totally. Now, when we come to physics and we talk of sound and harmonics, how would you compare that to what we just discussed with us?
You see, it is like this. If you take a pot and you sort of knock on it with knuckles, it makes some sound. It's very simple.
Yeah.
The physicist asks, how does the sound come? And what are the parameters on which the sound depends? For example, if you take one pot of a small size and a big size, obviously there will be a difference. So if you make a narrow neck and a wide neck, it will make a difference.
Yeah.
The quality of material use will make a difference.
Mm.
The place you bang will make a difference. The time of contact and the amount of energy you impart within that time will make a difference. So, the physicist's job is to study the science of sound production. The sound production could be from the throat or an instrument. The instrument can be a plucked instrument, a stringed instrument, which can be either plucked or bowed.
Mm.
Or it could be a percussion instrument where you
tabla,
your tabla
or
and all that. Or it could be an instrument where you blow air, starting
like
from the flute and so on, clarinet,
yes.
Nadaswaram and so on. So his job is to understand the science of this. And once you know the science of the instrument and vibrating instruments, they are generally vibrating instruments. They produce air column air vibrations. All of them produce air vibrations of some sort or the other. Then you can take it and apply it to various situations.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of music, you can say when do you get good music, when do you not get good music, which is the best way to produce play the bow and so on. The musicians discover all these things intuitively,
mm-hmm.
but it is systematized and what you call put on a scientific basis by the scientists.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Empiricism is converted into something like a discipline where things can be explained. In fact, you can also use this knowledge to improve things.
How do you mean?
For example, you can try to find out, you know, Stradivarius made violins of exceptional quality.
Right.
So everybody tried to find out what was the magic. They attributed to the wood that he cut from some place, to the varnish that he used, to the weathering, the season and all that. Now if you can find out the parameters, today you can produce violins which are 98% that quality. So that is one thing. The other thing is, I can invent totally new instruments.
Mm-hmm.
To produce sounds. And you have a lot of them these days. I don't think I know all of them.
Yes.
Is electronic music the producing systems. So, again, where did that come from?
Yes.
Because of your basic knowledge of how the vibrations are produced, the physics of the system, the techniques used by the musician, you combine that, you get a musical instrument.
You're right. I heard A.R. Rahman once perform in a live concert, and he, along with the professor in an American university, had come up with a new instrument, which was a combination of two previous and an improvisation on those, and he played some divine music on it. I forget the name of it. It was part piano, part something else.
Yeah. I mean, the keyboard is a classic example. Yeah. There was no keyboard when I was young.
Hmm.
Suddenly came about 20 years, 25 years ago. And they can make quite a lot of music out of it, which was unthinkable. Hmm.
Thanks to Casio and other companies, yes. They have done put a lot of research into it.
Well, they were betting and they won the bet.
Bet, absolutely. Hmm. Now, when we speak of bass and higher frequencies, such as octave, what does science have to say about it? How does science explain it?
You see, the simplest and the easiest way of explaining is to take a wire and then you tie it at two ends.
Okay.
One of the simplest ways is to put it in two what you call Coca-Cola box cans, put a knot there, put a knot there, and ask two people to stretch it and hold it stretched.
Like a nylon wire?
Not nylon, metal wire.
Metal wire.
Piano wire.
Piano wire, okay.
It has to be that kind of wire. It's always the wire. And then you pluck it.
Okay.
Now you can pluck it all over the place. You have to pluck it in a careful, scientific and controlled manner. So let us say you pluck it in the middle.
Mm.
And these people hold the tension. Of course, instead of that, in a laboratory, what we do is we have two knife edges which sit on a wooden box. The wire is stretched and we put two equal weights.
Uh-huh.
So we don't have to bother about stretching. Gravity will take care of it. Mm-hmm. We just pluck it. It will go in a loop like this, single loop. The whole string will be vibrating. Only the ends will be stationary.
I see.
That is called the fundamental mode.
Uh-huh.
It will have a certain frequency. That frequency can be adjusted by changing the length of the string and varying the tension. And there are infinite variations. I can make it very high, I can make it very low. Just let us freeze that and pluck it in the middle. I'll get a note, I call that fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
It is equivalent to sa in music. Normal sa. Every person has got a normal pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the vocal cords, you say sa, whatever it is. Then, the person sings re, ga, ma, pa, da, ni. Mm-hmm. 7 notes.
And
it is there
up
in the Western system and also in the Eastern system. 7 notes.
Right.
In physics, these 7 notes mean the following. Supposing I pluck the string again in such a manner that it has now 3 stationary points, 2 at the end and 1 in the middle.
I see.
So it will have a loop here and a loop here.
Okay, 2 loops.
So there is one more stationary point added to what we had. We had a 0, now we have 1.
Yeah.
Then like that you go up to 7. Then what happens is, in the 7th note, there will be 7 loops. 1 loop to 7 loops. 7. That is me. Next time you will get 8 loops. If from 7 loops you can strike it to make 8 loops. That 8th loop is called the octave.
Uh-huh.
And it will be the upper sa.
Uh-huh.
You say sa, then sa at the higher, this thing. So that is the upper sa. So between those two lies 7 notes. This 7-step staircase, sarigama padani sa, is the basis of what you call classical music, both in India, I don't know about China and Japan and all those countries, and in Western music. That is one thing that is common. Maybe it happened via Arabia or Greece or whatever it is. But we have got it, they have got it. And here, this staircase is sort of extended in various ways. And music built out of that staircase in one style in the south of India and another style in the north of India. So thus you get classical Hindustani music and classical Carnatic music.
Perhaps this is a good time to have an example of that recitation by one of the singers in the studio.
Sa re ga ma pa dha ni sa sa. dha pa ma ga re sa.
Steps, the staircase that you spoke of these notations, which are both common to Indian, Eastern as well as Western music, you said it's very important for a singer to stick to it because only then you will have that purity and the shruti, which is the right pitch. Can you elaborate on that, please?
Okay. I will do it using the language of physics.
Okay.
When I sing sa,
yes,
the fundamental, it has got a frequency. And that frequency is determined by the fact there is only one loop.
Okay.
Then when I sing re, which is the next note, it must have the frequency of the next mode, which has exactly two loops and no more.
Okay.
Actually, prepare a string and I pluck it. I can hear the sound. My re must match that sound. The next thing where there are three loops is ga. My ga must have that sound. So in the same way, if the seven notes that I sing with my throat, sa re ga ma pa da ni, if every one of the notes matches the staircase defined by physics, then I will say that is shruti shuddham. It is adhering to this. Supposing I sing re, say the frequency is not the same as what is given by my string. I have adjusted so that my sa and the strings are the same. So we are aligned there. Next step, I take one step. I should not take more. I should not take less. I must take exactly like the string.
There's a lot of grammar.
Oh, yeah. You bet. It is because of that grammar. You get words. You get literature.
In music also.
Exactly.
I'm astonished.
No, no. It is just like writing and painting. Painting, you have the so-called rainbow colors. You mix that, you get a variety and you get enormous richness. So it is just painting translated to the word, to the sound dimension.
I could also call it discipline. My God, there's so much of background discipline behind everything.
You bet there is discipline. In fact, a friend of mine used to call jazz as controlled apaswaram. They will go off key. And he said, I like that definition. It's very beautiful. I used to like jazz, I mean the old style. And it was controlled apaswaram.
And who was your favorite in jazz singer?
Oh, jazz singer, Louis Armstrong, of course.
Okay.
Satchmo.
No questions there. Now, this ability to hold a note, this is something that requires years of sadhana or practice.
You bet.
This is so tough, and we take it for granted when we hear a good singer. We don't know what kind of discipline has gone behind it.
And you also realize that when we sing, it is horrible because we don't have the discipline.
Exactly, and we have never practiced.
Thank
God Swami gave us this option to follow behind the lead singer, so we also feel we are part of this beautiful rendition. Otherwise, God forbid.
No, but don't mistake bhajans with this.
Of course.
Bhajans is a different genre.
Yeah.
And in fact, bhajans have certain rules of their own. This I didn't know. One musician who gave a demo lecture explained this. When it comes to the staircase, there is a similar staircase in as far as time is concerned. There is a thing called beat. And the speed of the beat, you make it exactly double, exactly three times, exactly four times. Now, there is a whole grammar with regard to percussion and beats, which I am not going into, and about which I know less than minimum. But in bhajan, there is an elasticity. You can increase the beats and suraras and so on. There is a flexibility. The second thing is that in bhajans, beauty of a good bhajan is, it is so composed that people can follow. You don't go around the swaras and notes which people cannot easily keep track of. If you listen to Pancharatnas, as you will be, we will be doing later.
Yes.
It is very intricate.
Yeah.
You can't just any.
No. Everybody just can't just chime in because
You no way.
You'll be totally
no.
lost.
So you see the amount of discipline required there. Even in bhajan, there is a lot of discipline required, but the demands are far, far less. And it has its own elasticity and rules of its own. One thing I did not know, so until I heard it from Sardar Raghunathan in a talk, where she paid a tribute to Mandolin Srinivas. She said it's very difficult to play the bhajans on the instruments, because they have their own grammar.
I see.
And you're not used to it. And she said mandolin used to play bhajans, five bhajans very well. I didn't realize that. That and I have followed later on. Whenever people try to play bhajans on instruments, they struggle.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's difficult. I never knew that. I took it for granted. See, our throat is so flexible, it can do any blessed thing. But even we are not able to play bhajans on instruments. It's not so easy.
And mandolin had that capacity, and even opera singers can hold that note.
They're better, otherwise they won't get their salary.
Oh, this is a really amazing world that we haven't quite explored. Now, talking of opera
singer, can I tell you something which is totally unrelated to this? I once got a question from a Turkish lady who was an opera singer in New York, and she was having some professional problem. And she asked me some question about dharma. What is my dharmic attitude in this question? I was taken aback. Here I was sitting in Radio Sai, and I'm getting a question from a Turkish lady. She probably is a Muslim. And she's in
New York.
She's employed as an opera singer in New York. And she has a problem in dharma. So I said, my God, Radio Sai seems to be sort of answer to everybody's problems.
Sometimes it seems like when we see some of the feedback. So what did you advise her, if I may ask?
I don't remember. And it's better I don't remember.
Okay. I'm sure it was very sage advice and it helped her. I can vouch for that. Now, moving along and speaking of Indian music, our origin goes back to the Vedas.
Definitely.
Rig Veda?
No. Rig Veda was just routine chanting of the Vedas. But the Sama Veda introduced a musicality to the chanting of the Rig Vedas. Chanting the Vedas in the Sama style, it is called Samagam, and they practice it. It has a rhythm and a beat of its own. In Rig Veda, you are essentially busy praising the Lord or the deities or whatever it is. Here, you try to draw the attention of the deities by making it more attractive.
Melodious.
You put a bit of icing on the cake. And that allowed the voice to go from one level to another, move around and so on. There is a range. But the Vedic range was very restricted. In due course, the Saptaswaras were discovered. I'm sure it was a discovery. There were no physics professors at that time. And they must have just got it by listening to nature and things like that. You know, if you listen to some birds, they go through a lot of scale. So, maybe they got the inspiration to take it to a different level. And from that time, music slowly evolved. And the codification was all done only around 1500 or so. Till that time, we have no history of exactly how these things evolved. And there was definitely a mixture, because through neighbors, Afghanistan and Persia, there has been a lot of especially in the north, because the sitar appears to have gone from here to there, the sarod appears to have come from there to here, and things like that. But there are certain things that are unique to India. The instrumental side, veena, that is unique. It was associated with goddess Saraswati. It's a purely Indian instrument. Tambura, of course, is purely Indian. It's not found anywhere else, at least to my knowledge. And then the tabla and the mridangam were very unique percussion instruments. And also ghatam, which is played only in South India, the pot. So there are what I would call something which you can defend as ancient intellectual property.
Of India.
Which they cannot patent anywhere else.
Yes, India should file a patent before somebody else does, before America does, indeed. And, you know, you spoke of Ravana. I remember in your discussion you were talking that Ravana's contribution to that early Vedic music.
What I mean is, it is said in the scriptures. You see, Ravana is actually the grandson of Brahma, the creator. He was a Brahmin. And he was a great devotee of Shiva.
Shiva, yes.
Which is interesting. And Shiva likes to dance. And he used to chant the Sama Veda in such a way that Shiva would dance. He would make him dance, mm-hmm. literally. And then ask for boons. Mm-hmm. That was all part of the divine drama.
And he also chanted that Shiva Panchakshara Sotram or one
that
of the
I
Shiva...
That I don't know, but Ravana was supposed to have made Shiva dance mm-hmm. to Sama Veda and got boons. Mm-hmm. So this is common folklore. But the point is, if a man could do such a thing, mm. he could still be a villain because of the mind. That is what the Ramayana teaches. That's why Swami used to say, Ravana had studied all the 64 vidyas.
Subjects, yeah.
Whereas Rama had studied only 32.
Yeah.
But yet, he was a prey to his mind because of desire.
Yes.
So that is what the folklore says. But from my point of view, I'm just trying to say that music has the power to what you call awaken the divine, if I may put it that way, and get the divine interested in you.
And Swami says, wherever my glory is sung, I am installed there. I mean, that is one weakness of God, good music.
I would say, yes. Good music, in fact, he sometimes goes even further. Even if the music is bad, if the heart is very
yes.
good, he will bend. I've seen Swami do that. Sometimes he will go out to praise somebody and you say, what the hell, this fellow sang so badly. He doesn't look at the sound. He looks beyond the sound, heart. So he was a very good heart doctor.
I remember one time Kailash Kher sang those Sufi bhajans in front of Swami. They were full of adoration and love, referring to God as his beloved. And Swami was so super pleased and gave him a ring. And then he called him back and gave him a necklace and called him back and blessed him on his head. There was such profusion of grace flowing towards Kailash Kher that day.
I don't remember that incident. Maybe I was not here at that time. But I don't suppose it happened again, because usually these things tend to be flashes.
One time.
And talking of one time, I must say the only musician I've seen who came to Swami spontaneously and regularly without expecting anything was Mandalin Srinivas. He really had a love for Swami and a bhakti for Swami. Mm-hmm. He would just come sit quiet and go away, that's all. Any number of times. Because we were sort of sitting very close in the Vedanta, so I used to talk to him, how are you? You'll have the sun go away. That's all.
Didn't come to perform or have
a
concert.
No, no, no.
For darshan.
People, regular darshan, like people come from Hyderabad and all that, he would feel like darshan, he'll just come, he'll have go. Once in a while, Swami will ask, have you brought your instrument?
Mm-hmm.
Play this evening. That was not very often, but he did that. But he came just for darshan.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody said, Swami has not called me, therefore I didn't come. None of that business. And he was such a modest man. It's very difficult to find a modest musician, I can tell you. I've interacted with a few of them. He was truly modest. And I know that because he has praised other musicians. He will say, this song you must hear so-and-so play on the flute.
Mm-hmm.
This song you must hear so-and-so play on the nadaswaram.
Wow. Yeah.
Do you know this musician did this? This song must be sung by so-and-so.
You have to have an enormity of heart to compliment another fellow musician.
Yes. His mind was
very broad,
so pure and so nice.
And I guess, as our listeners will discover through this series, he played a great role in the origin of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis, and we will come to it much later in the discussion. So I guess that explains why Swami gave him that opportunity.
By the way, he came here in this very studio and he said, don't have a false ceiling. He said, just leave it alone. It has better reverb. False ceiling will kill the reverb.
Oh,
he and
see.
His brother came during the construction days.
I see.
He just took a look around. His brother is a sound engineer. They just did some clapping and this and that. And he said...
Well, that explains why things are...
No, they had an ear for the hall's acoustics. And we left it at that.
Well, may he rest in peace. And he would be happy to know that we followed up on his advice.
I have to mention one more thing.
Please.
When I got to know him many years ago And when we did the five-part series, which is still to end, completed rather, the first part, which was called Advent, I asked him to do the background music.
Mm.
And I put in two requests. Please make sure those songs are there.
Mm.
He did the complete background scoring in 2 days in the other studio. He called Siltar people, he called the other fellows, and then he sort of saw the rushes and told them what to do. And in 2 days, he had the background score complete.
Wow.
Flat.
What a genius.
More than that, he worked with ordinary people. The geniuses don't talk to ordinary people.
Yes, they have such airs about themselves.
He talked to some of our fellows and then...
Our music boys.
We just had to collect the crown from Prashanthi instantly. Mm. What can you get?
Mm.
And he made gold out of that.
Wow. What a gift.
That next gift time you get hold of a copy of Advent, close your eyes and just...
listen to the background score.
I wanted him, you know, when Swami first comes out, I wanted him to play the song of Tyagaraja, Paramatmadu in Bhagadishwari. Because one day Swami opened the door and came there, put that music.
Mm.
I was just blown over. I never forgot that. So, he did that. When Swami comes for the first time, he plays that. And it sits so well. So, in another place, there is a Tyagaraja song, Mokshama Velata.
Uh-huh.
That is also used to be played by T.R. Malingam very nicely. He found a spot in the film. He played Mokshama Velata beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
If you know music, you say, my God, it fits like a glove.
Mm.
But it flows very nicely. And he was so nice. He talked to all our boys. He didn't mind any flaws or anything. He encouraged them and we got something out of it.
And I urge our listeners to catch hold of a copy of The Advent. It's a documentary and available in the Sai Blossom stores here. And I think now when you watch it, you will watch it with different eyes and different ears because you know the background behind it. Now, you earlier mentioned that, you know, God loves, of course, good music, but it has to, more important is that it has to come from the heart. So that brings us to this topic of raga, bhava and tala.
Yes.
So everything has to be balanced that makes good music. That is melody, rhythm and feeling or emotions.
See, it depends on what you mean by good music.
Inspiring, touching.
No, there are a lot of people who give concerts these days. They produce what I would call good technical music. Whereas, for me, the tradition of music demands that it be a conveyor of bhakti. Music is treated as a conveyor belt. And unless bhakti sits on that conveyor belt, it is not true music. Whereas today, people have managed, because of their materialistic nature, to take out that bhakti and just present music. And this allows them to do certain things in terms of gymnastics and all that, which were not considered norm in olden times.
Mm-hmm.
There was a paddhati, a procedure and a protocol. When you sang for God, you did that way. You don't show off. Whereas if you go to a concert, you have a show off. So I would distinguish a performance
mm-hmm.
from an offering.
I see.
You get my point?
Yes,
I do. Is it clear enough?
Yeah.
In the old days, it was always an offering.
Mm-hmm.
Because concerts, if any, would be performed in a temple. And in a temple, there is a deity. Therefore, notionally, you are performing for the deity.
Mm.
And because in those days, these were sponsored by big people and all that.
Kings and royal families.
Patrons were there.
Yeah.
And there were occasions. People would sing with feelings. People would sing with feelings.
Actually, there are many videos of M.S. Subbalakshmi singing these songs of adoration for God, and she's herself blissed out. I don't know how she stuck to her notes and this staircase of notes that you speak of, because her eyes are closed and you can see she's so involved with the music.
She says very clearly, I saw a video of a practice session where she just has a charpai, what we call pai, which can be rolled.
Uh-huh.
And she has not even a tambura, a shruti box, old style.
Mm.
And she sings. And there she says, you must practice a lot. There is no substitute for that. And it says it must have bhakti.
Mm.
That she insists. Bhakti doesn't mean that you offer and say, come on, give me this, give me that. I just am singing to show that I love you. And there is a famous story in the north in relation to singing for God, in relation to bhakti. And you are aware of that story? Or if you are,
which one?
If you are not and if you are interested,
please
I already tell you.
Please share it.
This is a story that relates to Akbar. And he had his court musician, Tansen. And he liked Tansen's music, and Tansen's music was, of course, very good, but he was more in what you call flattery of the Lord, master, the emperor, Akbar. Akbar was a very cultured man, and one day he said, Tansen, you sing very well. You must have had a great teacher. He said, of course I had a great teacher. I would like to meet that teacher, Akbar said. And Tansen said, come on, don't try such things. He doesn't meet anybody, he's a recluse. No, I am bent on meeting him. You know, up to a point you can defy an emperor. Then Tansen said, you have to submit my conditions. He said, what are your conditions? My guru lives in Rajasthan. You know, it's a desert with small villages. And you can come with your royal paraphernalia up to 10 miles of the village. Thereafter, you have to just come with me and you have to follow all my conditions. Are you ready? He was prepared to do anything. And then they go dressed in disguise. The last 10 miles, they go to a remote village, they go to a hut. And inside, the Tansen's guru Haridas is singing. And Akbar, tears flows from his eyes. And he's trying to go inside. Tansen pulls him. Signals go back. And then when they go back, Akbar says, Tansen, you sing very well, but guru sings better than you. He said, that is very simple, sir. So what do you mean simple? He says, I sing for you. He sings for him. You understand?
Yes.
So, he's singing in the seclusion of his house, remote hut in a remote village. And he is singing just to please God, whom he cannot see. He closes his eyes, he sings, and tears come out of it. This happens. In this Pancharatna, I was told, many people, they were sort of, tears were coming out of their eyes as they were singing. So, you can be moved to higher pitches of what you call ecstasy and resonate with God. Now that doesn't happen in a concert performance. A concert is different. In weddings they have concerts. That is entirely different. So I would like to say, I would like to keep concert music separate from what you call offerings to God.
And like the bhajans,
I'm making a old-fashioned technical
demarcation very clearly. And it's like the songs of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or Mirabai. They just have a totally different resonance.
Yeah.
Tukarams, Abhangs, and so on.
You are right. There is those are people for whom music was a vehicle, conveyor belt.
Yes, to reach God. Now, just a little bit of discussion on instruments will help us understand this better. Because strings, now, it's all about applying various degree of pressure in two ways. And that too, there is so much of grammar, there's so much of thought, again, for the tambura, the four strings, and how everything has to merge into this om. Would you care to help us understand that, please?
You have asked a question that is something pulled out of a melting pot, the whole of physics. I will answer it in the following way. Let's take the tambura first. I'm now talking about the musical instruments, not percussion instruments. Percussion instruments are a different story because they come with the respect to the beats.
Right.
Now, tambura has got four strings. They are all straight. They are very long, about a meter and a half or something like that on the average. And why four strings? The strings are of different thicknesses and you can adjust the tension. And the string at one end is tied to a wooden, what you call,
knob.
You can rotate it and tighten it. At the other end it is fixed, but there is a bridge over which it goes. The bridge is very curved and that is very important. So these four strings sort of make the string's thickness is, they vary. And if you pluck them in sequence, it will be almost like saying Om and merging in Om.
I see.
Akaram, Ukaram, Makaram, Omkaram. So, basically, historically, I presume it was to remind them of Om, Pranava sound. But total effect of those four strings is to produce a sa enriched with its octaves. If you just have a mechanical device, it will produce a sa which is bland. But here you don't want a bland sa. You want an enriched sa. So you add some octaves of that. The tambura allows you to add those octaves in a very ingenious way. And you get a very rich, so bass note, fundamental note. It's not a flat note that can be made by an electronic or mechanical this thing. It has a richness. So that is the first thing. Then if you take the stringed instruments, they come in different varieties. First is with frets and without frets. Violin has no frets, the veena has frets. Next is it plucked or bowed? Now in veena, you essentially pluck.
Yes.
In the violin, you bow.
Yes.
But every instrument has got a lot of flexibility, so that it produces its own richness. And every instrument has got an amplifier. The violin has got a dabba behind it, which amplifies the sound with a peculiar shape and all that. The veena has a huge, big resonator, almost like a tambura.
Yes.
So that also acts
veena
as...
Veena has two, right? A big one.
And the other side is more a sort
support
of...
Support, balancing?
It's not, it's more a support. You rest it on the ground. The main resonator is where the string is attached to this thing.
And it's made out of a big pumpkin, right?
Something like that.
Yes. And dried out.
It's made out of some kind of wood or pumpkin and things like that. Sitar is made out of similarly something like that. They are all organic. They are all organic. The raw material is natural. So on. And the ghatam is clay with a mixture of iron oxide. In some places there is a lot of natural iron oxide. And that is the place where they get a lot of ghatams made.
That is right. And this tambura that you were speaking of, it plays a very important part because it helps to maintain that shruti, the purity of the tone.
Yes.
That's why you always see there's a person with the tambura sitting behind every classical singer.
Fundamental. You see, basically that's a reference point. Sa. If that sa drifts.
Yeah, then you're off key.
You're off. So how do you know you're drifting or not? You see, for example, when you go on a highway, there are lines. So there is a midway, there is a road end, and because of that you can sort of drive in your lane. So you need some guidelines. The tambura provides a guideline. And you keep it close so that your sa stays all the way.
On track.
And if you are trained, then ri, ga, ma, pa, da, ni will all stay there.
Yeah, because if your first note is right, then everything
if
else
that
follows.
That goes on fluctuating like the rupee.
And the dollar, yes, then you're in deep trouble.
So far we have been discussing about notes and the scale and all that. Now there is a thing called the beat, because there is a time part.
Yes.
Music flows in time. So we need to have time markers. And the time markers are also important in terms of the meter of the lyrics and so on. You know, even without time, in poetry, there's a meter.
Yes.
And every sentence has to have a certain balance. You can't have one line of the poetry very long and another line just two words and so on and so forth. There is a sort of natural thirst for some time, rhythm and balance. Rhythm and balance in that rhythm. So, first is to have a way of reminding you of passage of equal intervals of time. So, we have the so-called metronome, which is used for certain time-marking purposes. It is used also in other situations to see whether the beat is steady or not. Now, you have to know the passage of time. How do you know the passage of time? So you keep on striking something like that. So then you know the passage of time. This is how drums came into existence. And because the fingers have got tremendous flexibility,
They are magical if you see Ustad Zakir Hussain playing.
Oh, those are all what you call peaks of human endeavor. So, they began to, within this time, they began to create complicated arrangements of beats.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you have arrangements of swaras,
yes,
they have arrangements of beats. In fact, they sometimes go together. The song is set to a certain kind of tala.
Yes.
And the percussion fellow tries to show off his skills within the framework that is available to him and within the framework of the musician's singing. And incidentally, I'll probably come to that later. Maybe you should remind me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, coming to the talas, it had its own grammar.
Mm-hmm.
And the grammar that was evolved in the south and north has certain commonalities. But south has its grammar, north has its grammar. There are certain places where they converge.
Mm-hmm.
Next comes the instrument. The drum appears to be very ancient because you see drums being played by tribes all over the world.
Yes, from Africa to China,
the Maori,
to everywhere, yes. Native Indians, everybody.
Drums are well known. Mm. Somehow everybody found out how to make a drum and drum it. But as Professor C.V. Raman said, the drum makes noise, which is true. But it's a time marker. And you don't mind it under certain circumstances. Marching bands, for example, they all have drums.
Mm.
But it goes with the sort of occasion. On the other hand, when you have intricate music with all these swaras and ragas and all what have you, you need a time marker which can match it in dignity and in capability and in support. It's a supporting instrument. And therefore, they said, what do we do with this drum? Can we do something?
Mm.
Now, the drum is a flat membrane. It has a flat membrane. And when you strike it, you know, when you pluck the string, I told you, you can pluck it in such a way that the modes generated are all multiples.
Mm.
And then harmonics. And then finally you get the octave. In the case of the drum, if you strike it, and then you study what are its vibrations, whether you get anything like a harmonic series, that problem belongs to mathematics. And it was first dealt with by a man, Swiss mathematician Bessel, I think his name was. Those were the harmonics, higher modes, normal modes, were given by what are called Bessel functions. They're complicated things, but you can calculate. So, if you calculate the higher frequencies, they don't come like Sarigamapadanisa. They come in their own way, which is natural to the circular membrane.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way physics is. And you really can't use it for this.
Mm.
But in the Western world, they use it, and they use it on occasions in such a way that it doesn't disturb. You don't have a drummer playing constantly in any Western program, except in rap and rock and all this
rock
stuff.
And roll, yeah.
Okay. In our music, the tradition is from Nandi, who used to play the drum for Shiva.
The Buddha.
So they made the drum, they tinkered with the drum membrane to make it not uniform, but non-uniform. And they did it empirically by adding paste, iron filings and this and that. And so they gave it a black spot.
Mm. In the center?
Well, it depends. In the mridangam, you have it in the center on one side.
Yeah.
In the tabla, there are two tablas.
A smaller tabla.
Yeah. In one, it is in the center. In the other, it is in an eccentric thing.
Okay.
That base is made out of metal.
Yes.
Whereas the main tabla is made of wood.
Mm.
And that is where all the, what you call the gymnastic is done.
Mm.
All the finger play is done and it produces notes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mridangam also, one musician, Paul Gartman, he could produce seven notes. Saptaswaras, he could evoke it to make, produce seven notes. And then, the drummer, normally it is supposed to compete with this man, singer. But in the Carnatic music, old style, the drummer was supposed to, the mridangam vidwan, I should say more technically, was supposed to sort of be in harmony with the musician.
Mm-hmm.
He has a conversation with the musician, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on the way he sings, he will adjust.
Mm-hmm.
And I have heard Mannargudi Iswaran, who is a Mridangam player, say that, you know, the musician may sing the same song differently on different days. You must adjust. It's not the song, it's the way he plays on that day.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes due to touring, he'll be very tired.
Mm-hmm.
On that day, the song will not shine.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to make up for him and bat at your end,
mm-hmm,
and make the song shine.
Yes.
So it's a sort of a partnership.
Ship, yes.
It's a very interesting association.
And we saw beautiful mridangam being played during the Sai Pancharatna Kritis.
Yeah, because they were all controlled by a discipline.
Mm, very nice it was. Yeah, I guess it's a partnership, a whole team thing. I think
you get the idea.
I do.
See, the fundamental point about our music is it is centered around the vocal tradition. Western music did not start with a vocal tradition. It had a vocal tradition in the church, the choir singing and all that. It was there in every church, Catholic and Protestant. But there were music written specially for the musicians. You go to even before all the great masters, Vivaldi's Four Seasons.
Mm.
It's entirely in the violin. He was a priest or something like that in the Catholic Church in Rome. He just wrote the music and it has its own magic. It was written for the violin.
Mm-hmm.
And then they write it for the cello.
Mm-hmm.
They write it for the piano.
Mm-hmm.
Piano concerto, so on and so forth. That is a genius of a certain kind, where these notes hang without words. Whereas, in our music, it was so tied to bhakti, the bhakti had to go with words.
Mm-hmm.
And notes were used. Whereas they felt, they showed their mood. All of them were Bach worked in a church in Leipzig. And he composed so many symphonies and all stuff like that. But he was pouring his, what you call...
spirit.
It was very spiritual.
Mm.
So sometimes, according to their tradition, words are irrelevant.
Mm.
Whereas here, we adore, we flatter God, left and right. And we need words for that. So, and therefore, the instruments become accompaniments. It's a sort of an interesting historical annotation. At least that is my reading. It is empirically supported, but I don't know whether academics will accept it.
And Radio Sai has a lot of listeners who are avid musicians, so we will get a lot of feedback. And I think at this point in time, seeing that the time has just flown and I have learned so much, I'm reasonably sure that our listeners will love this discussion.
I don't think you learned from me. You must have been thinking along as I spoke.
No, I was discovering new things, honestly. It was fantastic, great learning for myself. Although I sort of read through and prepared myself, but no, this was a lot of new stuff which I had never given thought to or realized how deep it is, and I'm sure we're only scratching the surface.
You're right. I don't know all that much about music, but I really know one thing. I know what music is really meant for, and I know what good music is supposed to be. You asked about raga, bhava, tala.
Mm.
It really comes to that. The song that is sung in adoration must have the raga.
Mm.
The bhava. Bhava means the proper feeling.
Mm.
And the tala, which is the beat. The feeling which comes in between is extremely important. And I will narrate an incident in the life of Tyagaraja, who was devoted to Rama and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And then, because he was a good musician, his brother said, why don't you come one day to the court of the king? Because his father worked in the king's court, Rama Brahmam, Tanjavur Maharaja. And you sing there, you will get a lot of gifts and so on and so forth. And he simply says, no, I won't do that. And he sings the famous song, Niti Chala Sugama, Ramudu Sanniti Chala Sugama. That means, will wealth give you more happiness or the darshan of Rama?
Hmm.
Niti Chala Sugama, Ramudu Sanniti Chala Sugama. So, he says, music is not for sale. That is Haridas in the Western Northern tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, I do it because I live with Rama. I am having a daily conversation with him. It's all that. So there is what I call a very, very spiritual tradition about our music. Purandara Dasa, Tyagaraja, Muthuswami Dikshitar, Shyama Sastri. And I am a sort of an old-fashioned, what you call, purist. You may call me a fundamentalist.
No, we'll stick to the word purist. I think that's more politically correct and that defines you better. And I'm going to request you to perhaps bring us up to speed about the Tyagaraja tradition and more about these great saints who gave music such a high place, such as Purandara Dasa, in the next episode, which will be episode number 2. And in episode 3, we'll talk about the Sai Pancharatna Kritis. On that wonderful note of learning so much from you, sir, I thank you deeply. And Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, and thank you for having me. It was an enjoyable experience, and I learned a few things also.
Great pleasure having you, sir, and I request all our listeners to share their thoughts, comments, and feedback on this program with us by writing to us, as always, at listener@radiosai.org. Thank you, and Sai Ram. Sai Ram, dear listeners, and welcome back to Morning Glory on Thursday Live. We are coming to you live from Prashanthi Nilayam. On this 16th of June 2016, the time in the ashram right now is 47 minutes past 10 a.m., that is Indian Standard Time. So, I hope you enjoyed this primer on sound, music and musicology, and the role of all three in the adoration of God. Please, as I requested you a moment ago, take a moment to send us your feedback on today's special conversation on the splendor of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis. You can reach us immediately by email at listener@radiosai.org and feel free to CC me or copy me at karuna@radiosai.org. So now, I'm going to play for you one Kriti from the Sai Pancharatna Kritis that were offered in the Divine Presence at this year's Aradhana Mahotsavam in Prashanthi Nilayam. Today, I have selected a composition, Satya Sai Avatara Vaibhavam, for your listening pleasure. And I must take a moment to mention that all the 5 kritis have been composed by Professor Vasanta Lakshmi of the Sri Satya Sai Mirpuri College of Music here in Prashanthi Nilayam. You will hear more details about that in the final episode, which is part 3. The kriti Satya Sai Avatara Vaibhavam is in Carnatic style, of course, and it will be followed by the melodious audio special from Team Radio Sai in the voice of Ms. Niranjana Mahalingam. It's titled Radha's Final Plea. So, you must stay with us for the entire duration of Morning Glory to enjoy Pata Padamu Krishna and Satya Sai Avatara Vaibhavam. And before I leave you on a musical high, I have one last request for all our listeners. Even though I will be away from the studio for the next few Thursdays, I have lined up the next 2 parts of this special conversation, I would say this very special conversation on the splendor of the Sai Pancharatna Kritis. So next Thursday and the Thursday after, I have lined up parts 2 and part 3. So please continue to tune in to Morning Glory every Thursday till I come back, and I promise you, this only gets better with each episode. On a lighter note, there are quite a few interesting asides that we managed to capture in the upcoming episodes, including how Professor G.V. knows so much about music. The answer is so interesting, I promise. And of course, so many more spiritually important facts. With that, this is Ant, and I also request you that each time you hear part 2, part 3, keep sending in your feedback. We'll pass it on to Professor and to my guest in the last episode is Professor G.V. as well as my colleague, Brother C.G. Sai Prakash. And if you have a question or query, we'll request them to get back to you. With that, this is a very grateful and happy Karuna bidding you Sai Ram as I leave you to enjoy some amazing devotional music in a variety of styles. Jai Sai Ram.
Satya Sai Avatara Vaibhavam. Satya
Incessant flow of worship to Krishna was Radha's very life. In thoughts of Krishna, she was forever lost. His form danced before her eyes every moment, wakeful and dream. The blue hues of the gurgling Yamuna reminded her of Krishna's charming complexion. The merry chirping of birds stirred in her memories of Krishna's mischievous chuckles. In Vrindavan, when Krishna would play upon his flute, her days passed like moments, filling every moment with that memory she spent her days. All that stood between Krishna and Radha's union was her mortal frame. The day finally came when even that would seamlessly slip away.
Okka korika korindi paapuku Radha.
Radha had one desire.
నాకింకేమి వద్దు స్వామి.
ఐ డోంట్ వాంట్ ఎనీథింగ్ మోర్ స్వామి.
మీ మురళిని ఒక్కతూరి వాయించండి, నేను వింటాను సార్.
ఐ వాంట్ టు లిసన్ టు యువర్ ఫ్లూట్.
పాట పాడు మా కృష్ణ పలుకుతేనే లొలుకునంటాడు.
యు సింగ్ ద గ్లోరీ అండ్ ద మెలడీ సో దట్ అవర్ హార్ట్స్ ఆర్ ఫుల్.
పాట పాడు కృష్ణ పలుకుతేనే లొలుకునంటాడు.
పాట పాడేటప్పటికి వినింది.
She heard.
ప్రాణం విడిచింది.
She breathed her last.
ప్రాణం విడిచడమే కాకుండా ఆనాటి నుంచి కూడా మురళిని పట్టడం కూడా మానివేశాడు.
Since then Krishna did not pick up that flute again.
రాధాకు ఈ యొక్క మురళిని త్యాగం చేశాడు.
He sacrificed this flute for her.
ఆ గానంను త్యాగం చేశాడు.
And then the melody too.
నట్ట కడపటి పాట కృష్ణుడు ఇదొక్కటే చెప్పింది.
In fact this was the last song of Krishna.
రాధ చాలా గొప్ప భక్తురాలు.
Radha is an ardent devotee.
కనుకనే భక్తికి అంత గొప్ప విలువనిచ్చారు.
Devotion is highly valuable.
ఇట్టి భక్తిని ఆనాటి నుంచి గోపికలు జగత్తునకు వ్యాప్తి గావించేటట్టుగా అనేక ప్రచార ప్రపంచములు చేస్తూ వచ్చారు.
This principle of devotion has been taught and shared and propagated by these gopikas.